visor in sequence, and I said, "I have a problem. The transmission fell out of my car, and you have me in a 7:30 a.m. and 8:30 a.m. class. If you could please just transfer me to the afternoon sections of those classes, I would appreciate it because of this car problem." There was a neighbor who was a rancher who was going to take me in at 11 o'clock. My advisor was this cowboy-looking guy with a handlebar mustache dressed in a tweed jacket. He said, "Well, son, after looking at your transcript at Reed College, I can see you have yet to learn that everyone has to make sacrifices to get an education. Request denied." So I went to the dean. Same treatment. His voice grew tight. He was describing things that had happened over 30 years ago, but the memory still made him angry. At that point, I realized here I was, knocking myself out to make the money to make my way back to school, and it's the middle of the Montana winter. I am willing to hitchhike into town every day, do whatever I had to do, just to get into school and back, and they are unwilling to do anything for me. So bananas. And that was the point I decided I could do without the higher education system. Even if I couldn't do without it, it was sufficiently repugnant to me that I wouldn't do it anymore. So I dropped out of college. Simple as that. Chris Langan's experiences at Rita, Montana State represented a turning point in his life. As a child, he had dreamt of becoming an academic. He should have gotten a PhD. Universities are institutions structured in large part for people with his kind of deep intellectual interests and curiosity. "Once he got into the university environment, I thought he would prosper. I really did," his brother Mark says. "I thought he would somehow find a niche. It made absolutely no sense to me when he left that." Without a degree, Langan floundered. He worked in construction. One frigid winter, he worked on a clam boat in Long Island. He took factory jobs and minor civil service positions and eventually became a bouncer in a bar on Long Island, which was his principal occupation through much of his adult years. Through it all, he continued to read deeply in philosophy, mathematics, and physics as he worked on a sprawling treatise he calls the CTMU, the Cognitive Theoretical Model of the Universe. But without academic credentials, he despairs of ever getting published in a scholarly journal. "I'm a guy who has a year and a half of college," he says with a shrug. "And at some point this will come to the attention of the editor, as he's going to take the paper and send it off to the referees, and these referees are going to try and look me up, and they're not going to find me. And they're going to say, 'This guy has a year and a half of college. How can he know what he's talking about?'" It is a heartbreaking story. At one point I asked Langan whether he would take a job at Harvard University, hypothetically, were it offered to him. "Well, that's a difficult question," he replied. "Obviously, as a full professor at Harvard, I would count. My ideas would have weight, and I could use my position, my affiliation at Harvard, to promote my ideas. An institution like that is a great source of intellectual energy, and if I were at a place like that, I could absorb the vibration in the air." It was suddenly clear how lonely his life had been. Here he was, a man with an insatiable appetite for learning, forced for much of his adult life to live in intellectual isolation. "I even noticed that kind of intellectual energy in the year and a half I was in college," he said, almost wistfully. "Ideas are in the air constantly. It's such a stimulating place to be." "On the other hand," he went on, "Harvard is basically a glorified corporation, operating with a profit incentive. That's what makes it tick. It has an endowment in the billions of dollars. The people running it are not necessarily searching for truth and knowledge. They want to be big shots. And when you accept a paycheck from those people, it is going to come down to what you want to do and what you feel is right versus what the man says you can do to receive another paycheck. When you're there, they got a thumb right on you. They're out to make sure you don't step out of line." What does the story of Chris Langan tell us? His explanations, as heartbreaking as they are also a little strange. His mother forgets to sign his financial aid form and, just like that, no scholarship. He tries to move from a morning to an afternoon class, something students do every day, and gets stopped cold. And why were Langan's teachers at Rita, Montana State so indifferent to his plight? Teachers typically delight in minds as brilliant as his. Langan talks about dealing with Rita, Montana State as if they were some kind of vast and unyielding government bureaucracy. But colleges, particularly small liberal arts colleges like Reed, tend not to be rigid bureaucracies. Making allowances in the name of helping someone stay in school is what professors do all the time. Even in his discussion of Harvard, it's as if Langan has no concept of the culture and particulars of the institutions he's talking about. When you accept a paycheck from these people, it's going to come down to what you want to do and what you feel is right versus what the man says you can do to receive another paycheck. What? One of the main reasons college professors accept a lower paycheck than they could get in private industry is that university life gives them the freedom to do what they want to do and what they feel is right. Langan has Harvard backwards. When Langan told me his life story, I couldn't help but think of the life of Robert Oppenheimer, the physicist who famously headed the American effort to develop the nuclear bomb during World War II. Oppenheimer, by all accounts, was a child with a mind very much like Chris Langan's. His parents considered him a genius. One of his teachers recalled that he received every new idea as perfectly beautiful. He was doing lab experiments by the third grade and studying physics and chemistry by the fifth grade. When he was 9, he once told one of his cousins, "Ask me a question in Latin and I will answer you in Greek." Oppenheimer went to Harvard and then on to Cambridge University to pursue a doctorate in physics. There, Oppenheimer, who struggled with depression his entire life, grew despondent. His gift was for theoretical physics, and his tutor, a man named Patrick Blackett, who would win a Nobel Prize in 1948, was forcing him to attend to the minutiae of experimental physics, which he hated. He grew more and more emotionally unstable, and then, in an act so strange that to this day no one has properly made sense of it, Oppenheimer took some chemicals from the laboratory and tried to poison his tutor. Blackett, luckily, found out that something was amiss. The university was informed. Oppenheimer was called on the carpet. And what happened next is every bit as unbelievable as the crime itself. Here is how the incident is described in American Prometheus, Kai Bird and Martin Sherwin's biography of Oppenheimer. After protracted negotiations, it was agreed that Robert would be put on probation and have regular sessions with a prominent Harley Street psychiatrist in London. Probation? Here we have two very brilliant young students who run into a problem that imperils their college careers. Langan's mother has missed a deadline for his financial aid. Oppenheimer has tried to poison his professor. To continue on, they are required to plead their case to authority. And what happens? Langan gets his scholarship taken away, and Oppenheimer gets sent to a psychiatrist. Oppenheimer and Langan might both be geniuses, but in other ways they could not be more different. The story of Oppenheimer's appointment to be scientific director of the Manhattan Project, 20 years later, is perhaps an even better example of this difference. The general in charge of the Manhattan Project was Leslie Groves, and he scoured the country trying to find the right person to lead the atomic bomb effort. Oppenheimer, by rights, was a long shot. He was just 38 and junior to many of the people who he would have to manage. He was a theorist, and this was a job that called for experimenters and engineers. His political affiliations were dodgy. He had all kinds of friends who were communists. Perhaps more importantly, he had never had any administrative experience. He was a very impractical fellow, one of Oppenheimer's friends later said. He walked about with scuffed shoes and a funny hat, and more important, he didn't know anything about equipment. As one Berkeley scientist put it more succinctly, he couldn't run a hamburger stand. Oh, and by the way, in graduate school, he tried to kill his professor. This was the resume of the man who was trying out for what might be said, without exaggeration, to be one of the most important jobs of the 20th century. And what happened? The same thing that happened 20 years earlier at Cambridge. He got the rest of the world to see things his way. Here are Bird and Sherwin again. Oppenheimer understood that Groves guarded the entrance to the Manhattan Project, and he therefore turned on all his charm and brilliance. It was an irresistible performance. Groves was smitten. "He's a genius," Groves later told a reporter, "a real genius." Groves was an engineer by training, with a graduate degree from MIT, and Oppenheimer's great insight was to appeal to that side of Groves. Bird and Sherwin go on, Oppenheimer was the first scientist Groves had met on his tour of potential candidates who grasped that building an atomic bomb required finding practical solutions to a variety of cross-disciplinary problems. Groves found himself nodding in agreement when Oppenheimer pitched the notion of a central laboratory devoted to this purpose, where, as he later testified, we could come to grips with chemical, metallurgical, engineering, and ordnance problems that had so far received no consideration. Would Oppenheimer have lost his scholarship at Reed? Would he have been unable to convince his professors to move his classes to the afternoon? Of course not. And that's not because he was smarter than Chris Langan. It's because he possessed the kind of savvy that allowed him to get what he wanted from the world. They required that everyone take introductory calculus, Langan said of his brief stay at Montana State, and I happened to get a guy who taught it in a very dry, very trivial way. I didn't understand why he was teaching it this way, so I asked him questions. I actually had to chase him down to his office. I asked him, why are you teaching this way? Why do you consider this practice to be relevant to calculus? And this guy, this tall, lanky guy, always had sweat stains under his arms. He turned and looked at me and said, you know, there's something you should probably get straight. Some people just don't have the intellectual firepower to be mathematicians. There they are, the professor and the prodigy. And what the prodigy clearly wants is to be engaged at long last with a mind that loves mathematics as much as he does. But he fails. In fact, and this is the most heartbreaking part of all, he manages to have an entire conversation with his calculus professor without ever communicating the one fact most likely to appeal to a calculus professor. The professor never realizes that Chris Langan is good at calculus. The particular skill that allows you to talk your way out of a murder rap or convince your professor to move you from the morning to the afternoon section is what the psychologist Robert Sternberg calls practical intelligence. To Sternberg, practical intelligence includes things like knowing what to say to whom, knowing when to say it, and knowing how to say it for maximum effect. It is procedural. It's about knowing how to do something without necessarily knowing why you know it or being able to explain it. It's practical in nature. That is, it's not knowledge for its own sake. It's knowledge that helps you read situations correctly and get what you want. And, critically, it is a kind of intelligence separate from the sort of analytical ability measured by IQ. To use the technical term, general intelligence and practical intelligence are orthogonal. The presence of one doesn't imply the presence of the other. You could have lots of analytical intelligence and very little practical intelligence, or lots of practical intelligence and not much analytical intelligence, or, as in the lucky case of someone like Robert Oppenheimer, you can have lots of both. So where does something like practical intelligence come from? We know where analytical intelligence comes from. It's something, at least in part, that's in your genes. Chris Langan started talking at 6 months. He taught himself to read at 3. He was born smart. IQ is a measure, to some degree, of innate ability. But social savvy is knowledge. It's a set of skills that have to be learned. It has to come from somewhere. And the place where we seem to get these kinds of attitudes and skills is from our families. Perhaps the best explanation we have of this process comes from the University of Maryland sociologist Annette Leroux, who a few years ago conducted a fascinating study of a group of third graders. She picked both blacks and whites, and children from both wealthy homes and poor homes, zeroing in, ultimately, on 12 families. Leroux and her team visited each family at least 20 times for hours at a stretch. She and her assistants told their subjects, just treat us like the family dog. And they followed them to church and to soccer games and to doctor's appointments with a tape recorder in one hand and a notepad in the other. You might expect that if you spent such an extended period in 12 different households, what you would gather is 12 different ideas about how to raise children. There would be the strict parents and the lax parents and the hyper-involved parents and the mellow parents and on and on. What Leroux found, however, is something much different. There seemed to be only 2 parenting philosophies, and they divided almost perfectly along class lines. The wealthier parents raised their kids one way, and the poorer parents raised their kids another way. The wealthier parents were heavily involved in their children's free time, shuttling them from one activity to the next, quizzing them about their coaches and teammates. One of the well-off children Lero followed played on a baseball team, two soccer teams, a swim team, and a basketball team in the summer, played in an orchestra, and took piano lessons. That kind of intensive scheduling was almost entirely absent from the lives of the poor children. Play, for them, wasn't soccer practice twice a week. It was making up games outside with their siblings and other kids in the neighborhood. What a child did was considered by his or her parents as something separate from the adult world and not particularly consequential. One girl from a working-class family, Katie Brindle, sang in a choir after school. But she signed up for it herself and walked to choir practice on her own. Lero writes, "What Mrs. Brindle doesn't do that is routine for middle-class mothers is view her daughter's interest in singing as a signal to look for other ways to help her develop that interest into a formal talent." Similarly, Mrs. Brindle does not discuss Katie's interest in drama or express regret that she cannot afford to cultivate her daughter's talent. Instead, she frames Katie's skills and interests as character traits. Singing and acting are part of what makes Katie, Katie. She sees the shows her daughter puts on as cute and as a way for Katie to get attention. The middle-class parents would talk things through with their children, reasoning with them. They didn't just issue commands. They expected their children to talk back to them, to negotiate, to question adults in positions of authority. If their children are doing poorly, the wealthier parents challenge teachers. They intervene on behalf of their kids. One child Lero follows just misses qualifying for a gifted program. Her mother arranges for her to be retested privately, petitions the school, and gets her daughter admitted. The poor parents, by contrast, are intimidated by authority. They react passively and stay in the background. Lero writes of one low-income parent, "At a parent-teacher conference, for example, Mrs. McAllister, who is a high school graduate, seems subdued. The gregarious and outgoing nature she displays at home is hidden in this setting. She sits hunched over in the chair, and she keeps her jacket zipped up. She's very quiet. When the teacher reports that Harold has not been turning in his homework, Mrs. McAllister clearly is flabbergasted, but all she says is, 'He did it at home.' She does not follow up with the teacher or attempt to intervene on Harold's behalf. In her view, it is up to the teachers to manage her son's education. That is their job, not hers." Lero calls the middle-class parenting style concerted cultivation. It's an attempt to actively foster and assess a child's talents, opinions, and skills. Poor parents tend to follow, by contrast, a strategy of accomplishment of natural growth. They see their responsibility to care for their children, but to let them grow and develop on their own. Lero stresses that one style isn't morally better than the other. In fact, the poorer children were, to her mind, often better behaved, less whiny, more creative in making use of their own time, and had a well-developed sense of independence. But in practical terms, concerted cultivation has enormous advantages. The heavily scheduled middle-class child is exposed to a constantly shifting set of experiences. She learns teamwork and how to cope in highly structured settings. She is taught how to interact comfortably with adults and to speak up when she needs to. In Lero's words, the middle-class children learn a sense of entitlement. That word, of course, has negative connotations these days, but Lero means it in the best sense of the term. They acted as though they had a right to pursue their own individual preferences and to actively manage interactions in institutional settings. They appeared comfortable in those settings. They were open to sharing information and asking for attention. It was common practice among middle-class children to shift interactions to suit their preferences. They knew the rules. Even in fourth grade, Lero goes on, middle-class children appeared to be acting on their own behalf to gain advantages. They made special requests of teachers and doctors to adjust procedures to accommodate their desires. By contrast, the working class and poor children were characterized by what Lero calls an emerging sense of distance, distrust, and constraint. They didn't know how to get their way, or how to customize, in Lero's wonderful phrase, whatever environment they were in for their best purposes. In one telling scene, Leroux describes a visit to the doctor by Alex Williams, a 9-year-old boy, and his mother, Christina. The Williamses are wealthy professionals. "Alex, you should be thinking of questions you might want to ask the doctor," Christina says in a car on the way to the doctor's office. "You can ask him anything you want. Don't be shy. You can ask anything." Alex thinks for a moment, then says, "I have some bumps under my arms from my deodorant." Christina, "Really? You mean from your new deodorant?" Alex, "Yes." Christina, "Well, you should ask the doctor." Alex's mother, Leroux writes, is teaching that he has the right to speak up, that even though he's going to be in a room with an older person of authority, it's perfectly all right for him to assert himself. They meet the doctor, a genial man in his early 40s. He tells Alex that he's in the 95th percentile in height. Alex then interrupts. "Alex, I'm in the what?" "Doctor, it means that you're taller than more than 95 out of 100 young men when they're 10 years old." "Alex, I'm not 10. "Doctor, well, they graft you at 10. You're 9 years and 10 months. They usually take the closest year to that graph." Look at how easily Alex interrupts the doctor. "I'm not 10. That's entitlement. His mother permits that casual incivility because she wants him to learn to assert himself with people in positions of authority. The doctor turns to Alex. "Well now, the most important question. Do you have any questions you want to ask me before I do your physical?" "Alex, only one. I've been getting some bumps on my arms, right around here." He indicates his underarms. "Doctor, underneath?" "Alex, yeah." "Doctor, okay. I'll have to take a look at those when I come in closer to do the checkup, and I'll see what they are and what I can do. Do they hurt or itch?" "Alex, no, they're just there." "Doctor, okay, I'll take a look at those bumps for you." This kind of interaction simply doesn't happen with lower-class children, Leroux says. They would be quiet and submissive, with eyes turned away. Alex takes charge of the moment. In remembering to raise the question he prepared in advance, he gains the doctor's full attention and focuses it on an issue of his choosing, Leroux writes. In doing so, he successfully shifts the balance of power away from the adults and towards himself. The transition goes smoothly. Alex is used to being treated with respect. He is seen as special and as a person worthy of adult attention and interest. These are key characteristics of the strategy of concerted cultivation. Alex is not showing off during his checkup. He is behaving much as he does with his parents. He reasons, negotiates, and jokes with equal ease. It is important to understand where the particular mastery of that moment comes from. It's not genetic. Alex Williams didn't inherit the skills to interact with authority figures from his parents and grandparents the way he inherited the color of his eyes. Nor is it racial. It's not a practice specific to either black or white people. As it turns out, Alex Williams is black and Katie Brindle is white. Alex has those skills because over the course of his young life, his mother and father, in the manner of educated families, have painstakingly taught them to him, nudging and prodding and encouraging and showing him the rules of the game, right down to that little rehearsal in the car on the way to the doctor's office. When we talk about the advantages of class, Leroux argues, this is in large part what we mean. Alex Williams is better off than Katie Brindle because he's wealthier and because he goes to a better school, but also, and perhaps even more critically, because the sense of entitlement that he has been taught is an attitude perfectly suited to succeeding in the modern world. This is the advantage that Oppenheimer had over Chris Langan. He was raised in one of the wealthiest neighborhoods in Manhattan, the son of an artist and a successful garment manufacturer. His childhood was the embodiment of concerted cultivation. On weekends, the Oppenheimers would go driving in the countryside in a chauffeur-driven Packard. Summers, he would be taken to Europe to see his grandfather. He attended the Ethical Culture School on Central Park West, perhaps the most progressive school in the nation, where, his biographers write, students were infused with the notion that they were being groomed to reform the world. When his math teacher realized he was bored, she sent him off to do independent work. As a child, Oppenheimer's great passion was rock collecting. At the age of 12, he began corresponding with local geologists about rock formations he had seen in Central Park. And he so impressed them, they invited him to give a lecture before the New York Mineralogical Club. As Sherwin and Byrd write, Oppenheimer's parents responded to their son's hobby in an almost textbook example of concerted cultivation. Dreading the thought of having to talk to an audience of adults, Robert begged his father to explain that they had invited a 12-year-old. Greatly amused, Julius encouraged his son to accept this honor. On the designated evening, Robert showed up at the club with his parents, who proudly introduced their son as J. Robert Oppenheimer. The startled audience of geologists and amateur rock collectors burst out laughing when he stepped up to the podium. A wooden box had to be found for him to stand on so the audience could see more than the shock of his wiry black hair sticking up above the lectern. Shy and awkward, Robert nonetheless read his prepared remarks and was given a hearty round of applause. Is it any wonder Oppenheimer handled the challenges of his life so brilliantly? If you are someone whose father has made his way up in the business world, then you've seen firsthand what it means to negotiate your way out of a tight spot. If you're someone who was sent to the ethical culture school, then you aren't going to be intimidated by a row of Cambridge dons arrayed in judgment against you. If you studied physics at Harvard, then you know how to talk to an army general who did engineering just down the road at MIT. Chris Langan, by contrast, had only the bleakness of Bozeman and a home dominated by an angry, drunken stepfather. "Langan did this to all of us," said Mark. "We all have a true resentment of authority." That was the lesson Langan learned from his childhood. Distrust authority. Be independent. He never had a parent teach him, on the way to the doctor, how to speak up for himself and reason and negotiate with those in positions of authority. He didn't learn entitlement. He learned distrust, distance, and constraint. It may seem like a small thing, but it's a crippling handicap in navigating the world beyond Bozeman. "I couldn't get any financial aid either," Mark went on. "We had just zero knowledge, less than zero knowledge of the process. How to apply, the forms, checkbooks. It was not our environment." If Christopher had been born into a wealthy family, if he was the son of a doctor who was well-connected in some major market, I guarantee you he would have been one of those guys you read about, knocking back PhDs at 17, his brother Jeff says. It's the culture you find yourself in that determines that. The issue with Chris is that he was always too bored to actually sit there and listen to his teachers. If someone had recognized his intelligence, and if he was from a family where there was some kind of value on education, they would have made sure he wasn't bored. When the termites were into their adulthood, Terman looked at the records of 730 of the men and divided them into three groups. 150, the top 20%, fell into what Terman called the A group. These were the true success stories, the stars. The lawyers and physicians and engineers and academics. 90% of the A's graduated from college, and between them had earned 98 graduate degrees. The middle 60% were the B group, those who were doing satisfactorily. The bottom 150 were the C's, the one who Terman judged to have done the least with their superior mental ability. They were the postal workers and the struggling bookkeepers and the men lying on their couch at home without any job at all. 1/3 of the C's were college dropouts. 1/4 had only a high school diploma, and all 150 of the C's, each of whom at one point in their life had been dubbed a genius, had together earned a grand total of 8 graduate degrees. What was the difference between the A's and the C's? Terman ran through every conceivable explanation. He looked at their physical and mental health, their masculinity-femininity scores, and their hobbies and vocational interests. He compared what ages they started walking and talking and what their precise IQ scores were in elementary and high school. In the end, only one thing mattered: family background. The A's overwhelmingly came from the middle and the upper class. Their homes were filled with books. Half of the fathers of the A group had a college degree or beyond, at a time when a university education was a rarity. The C's, on the other hand, were from the other side of the tracks. Almost 1/3 of them had a parent who had dropped out of school before the 8th grade. At one point, Terman had his field workers go and visit everyone from the A and C group and rate their personalities and manner. What they found is everything you would expect to find if you were comparing children raised in an atmosphere of concerted cultivation with children raised in an atmosphere of natural growth. The A's were judged to be much more alert, poised, attractive, and well-dressed. In fact, the scores on those four dimensions were so different as to make you think you were looking at two different species of humans. You aren't, of course. You're simply seeing the difference between those schooled by their families to present their best face to the world and those denied that experience. The Terman results are deeply distressing. Let's not forget how highly gifted the C group was. If you had met them at 5 or 6 years of age, you would have been overwhelmed by their curiosity and mental agility and sparkle. They were true outliers. The plain truth of the Terman study, however, is that in the end, almost none of the genius children from the lowest social and economic class ended up making a name for themselves. What did the C's lack, though? Not something expensive or impossible to find. Not something encoded in DNA or hardwired into the circuits of their brains. They lacked something that we could have given them if we'd only known they'd needed it. A community around them that prepared them properly for the world. The C's were squandered talent. But they didn't need to be. Today, Chris Langan lives in rural Missouri on a horse farm. He moved there a few years ago after he got married. He's in his 50s but looks many years younger. He has the build of a linebacker, thick through the chest with enormous biceps. His hair is combed straight back from his forehead. He's a neat graying mustache and aviator-style glasses. If you look into his eyes, you can see the intelligence burning behind them. A typical day is, I get up and make coffee. I go in and sit in front of the computer and begin working on whatever I was working on the night before, he said, not long ago. I found if I go to bed with a question on my mind, all I have to do is concentrate on the question before I go to sleep, and I virtually always have the answer in the morning. Sometimes I realize what the answer is because I dreamt the answer, and I can remember it. Other times I just feel the answer, and I start typing and the answer emerges on the page. He had just been reading the work of the linguist Noam Chomsky. There were piles of books in his study. He ordered books from the library all the time. I always feel that the closer you get to the original sources, the better off you are, he said. Langan seemed content. He had farm animals to take care of, and books to read, and a wife he loved. It was a much better life than being a bouncer. I don't think there's anyone smarter than me out there, he went on. I have never met anyone like me, or never seen even an indication that there is someone who actually has better powers of comprehension. Never seen it, and I don't think I'm going to. I could. My mind is open to the possibility. But if anyone should challenge me, oh, I think I'm smarter than you are, I think I could have them. What he said sounded boastful. But it wasn't really. It was the opposite, a touch defensive. He had been working for decades now, but almost none of what he had done had ever been published, much less even read, by the physicists and philosophers and mathematicians who might be able to judge its value. Here he was, a man with a one-in-a-million mind, and he had yet to make any impact on the world. He wasn't holding forth at academic conferences. He wasn't leading a graduate seminar at some prestigious university. He was living in a slightly tumble-down horse farm in northern Missouri, sitting on the back porch in jeans and a cut-off T-shirt. He knew how it looked. It was the great paradox of Chris Langan's genius. I have not pursued mainstream publishers as hard as I should have, he conceded. Going around, querying publishers, trying to find an agent, I haven't done it, and I'm not interested in doing it. It was an admission of defeat. Every experience he had had outside of his own mind had ended in frustration. He knew he needed to do a better job of navigating the world, but he didn't know how. He couldn't even talk to his calculus teacher, for goodness sake. These were things that others with lesser minds could master easily. But that's because those others had had help along the way, and Chris Langan never had. It wasn't an excuse. It was a fact. He'd had to make his way alone, and no one, not rock stars, not professional athletes, not software billionaires, and not even geniuses, ever makes it alone. Chapter 5. The Three Lessons of Joe Flom. Mary Got a Quarter. Joe Flom is the last living named partner of the law firm Skadden, Arps, Slate, Marr, and Flom. He has a corner office high above the Condé Nast Tower in Manhattan. He is short and slightly hunched. His head is large, framed by long, prominent ears, and his narrow blue eyes are hidden by oversized aviator-style glasses. He is slender now, but during his heyday, Flom was extremely overweight. He waddles when he walks. He doodles when he thinks. He mumbles when he talks. And when he makes his way down the halls of Skadden Arps, conversations drop to a hush. Flom grew up in the Depression in Brooklyn's Borough Park neighborhood. His parents were Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe. His father, Isidore, was a union organizer in the garment industry who later went to work sewing shoulder pads for women's dresses. His mother worked at what was called piecework, doing appliqué at home. They were desperately poor. His family moved nearly every year when he was growing up because the custom in those days was for landlords to give new tenants a month's free rent, and without that his family could not get by. In junior high school, Flom took the entrance exam for the elite Townsend Harris Public High School on Lexington Avenue in Manhattan, a school that in just 40 years of existence produced 3 Nobel Prize winners, 6 Pulitzer Prize winners, and 1 Supreme Court justice, not to mention George Gershwin and Jonas Salk, the inventor of the polio vaccine. He got in. His mother would give him a dime in the morning for breakfast, 3 donuts, orange juice, and coffee at Needick's. After school, he pushed a hand truck in the garment district. He did 2 years of night school at City College in Upper Manhattan, working during the days to make ends meet, signed up for the Army, served his time, and applied to Harvard Law School. "I wanted to get into the law since I was 6 years old," Flom says. He didn't have a degree in college. Harvard took him anyway. Why? "I wrote them a letter on why I was the answer to sliced bread," is how Flom explains it. At Harvard, in the late 1940s, he never took notes. All of us were going through this first-year idiocy of writing notes carefully in the classroom and doing an outline of that, then a condensation of that, and then doing it again on onion skin paper on top of other paper, remembers Charles Haar, who was a classmate of Flom's. It was a routinized way of trying to learn the cases, not Joe. He wouldn't have any of that. But he had that quality which we always vaguely subsumed under thinking like a lawyer. He had the great capacity for judgment. Flom was Law Review, the honor reserved for the very top students in the class. During hiring season, the Christmas break of his second year, he went down to New York to interview with the big corporate law firms of the day. "I was ungainly, awkward, a fat kid. I didn't feel comfortable," Flom remembers. "I was one of 2 kids in my class at the end of hiring season who didn't have a job. Then one day, one of my professors said that there are these guys starting a firm. I had a visit with them, and the entire time I met with them, they were telling me what the risks were of going with a firm that didn't have a client. The more they talked, the more I liked them. So I said, what the hell? I'll take a chance." They had to scrape together the $3,600 a year, which was the starting salary. In the beginning, it was just Marshall Skadden and Leslie Arps, both of whom had just been turned down for partner at a major Wall Street law firm, and John Slate, who'd worked for Pan Am Airlines. Flom was their associate. They had a tiny suite of offices on the top floor of the Lehman Brothers building on Wall Street. "What kind of law did we do?" Flom says, laughing. "Whatever came in the door." In 1954, Flom took over as Skadden's managing partner, and the firm began to grow by leaps and bounds. Soon it had 100 lawyers, then 200. When it hit 300, one of Flom's partners, Morris Kramer, came to him and said he felt guilty about bringing in young law school graduates. Skadden was so big, Kramer said, that it was hard to imagine the firm growing beyond that and being able to promote any of those new hires. Flom told him, "Ah, we'll go to 1,000. Flom never lacked for ambition. Today, Skadden has nearly 2,000 attorneys in 23 offices around the world and earns well over $1 billion a year, making it one of the largest and most powerful law firms in the world. In his office, Flom has pictures of himself with George Bush Sr. and Bill Clinton. He lives in a sprawling apartment in a luxurious building on Manhattan's Upper East Side. For a period of almost 30 years, if you were a Fortune 500 company about to be taken over or trying to take someone else over, or merely a big shot in some kind of fix, Joseph Flom has been your attorney and Skadden has been your law firm, and if they weren't, you probably wish they were. I hope by now that you are skeptical of this kind of story. Brilliant immigrant kid, overcomes poverty in the Depression, can't get a job at the stuffy downtown law firm, makes it on his own through sheer hustle and ability. It's a rags-to-riches story. And everything we've learned so far from hockey players and software billionaires and the termites suggests that success doesn't happen that way. Successful people don't do it alone. Where they come from matters. They're products of particular places and environments. Just as we did then with Bill Joy and Chris Langan, let's start over with Joseph Flom, this time putting to use everything we've learned from the first half of this book. No more talk of Joe Flom's intelligence or personality or ambition, although he obviously has these three things in abundance. No glowing quotations from his clients testifying to his genius. No more colorful tales from the meteoric rise of Skadden, Arps, Slate, Marr, and Flom. Instead, I'm going to tell a series of stories from the New York immigrant world that Joe Flom grew up in. A fellow law student, a father and a son named Maurice and Mort Janklow, and an extraordinary couple by the name of Louis and Regina Borgenecht, in the hopes of answering a critical question. What were Joe Flom's opportunities? Since we know that outliers always have help along the way, can we sort through the ecology of Joe Flom and identify the conditions that helped create him? We tell rags-to-riches stories because we find something captivating in the idea of a lone hero battling overwhelming odds. But the true story of Joe Flom's life turns out to be much more intriguing than the mythological version, because all the things that seem in his life to have been disadvantages, that he was a poor child of garment workers, that he was Jewish at a time when Jews were heavily discriminated against, that he grew up in the Depression, turn out unexpectedly to have been advantages. Joe Flom is an outlier, but he's not an outlier for the reasons you might think. By the end of the chapter, in fact, we'll see that it is possible to take the lessons of Joe Flom, apply them to the legal world of New York City, and predict the family background, age, and origins of the city's most powerful attorneys without knowing a single additional fact about them. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Lesson number one, the importance of being Jewish. One of Joe Flom's classmates at Harvard Law School was a man named Alexander Bickel. Like Flom, Bickel was the son of Eastern European Jewish immigrants from Brooklyn. Like Flom, Bickel had gone to public school in New York City and then City College. Like Flom, Bickel was a star in his law school class. In fact, before his career was cut short by cancer, Bickel would become perhaps the finest constitutional scholar of his generation. And like Flom and the rest of their law school classmates, Bickel went to Manhattan during hiring season over Christmas of 1947 to find himself a job. His first stop was at Mudge Rose, down on Wall Street, as traditional and stuffy as any firm of that era. Mudge Rose was founded in 1869. It was where Richard Nixon practiced in the years before he won the presidency in 1968. We're like the lady who only wants her name in the newspaper twice, when she's born and when she dies, one of the senior partners famously said. Bickel was taken around the firm and interviewed by one partner after another until he was led into the library to meet with the firm's senior partner. You can imagine the scene, a dark paneled room, an artfully frayed Persian carpet, rows upon rows of leather-bound legal volumes, oil paintings of Mr. Mudge and Mr. Rose on the wall. After they put me through the whole interview and everything, Bickel would say, many years later, I was brought to the senior partner, who took it upon himself to tell me that for a boy of my antecedents, and you can imagine how Bickel must have paused before giving that euphemism for his immigrant background, I certainly had come far. But I ought to understand how limited the possibilities of a firm like his were to hire a boy of my antecedents. And while he congratulated me on my progress, I should understand he certainly couldn't offer me a job. But they all enjoyed seeing me and all that. It is clear from the transcript of Bickel's reminiscences that his interviewer does not quite know what to do with that information. Bickel was, by the time of the interview, at the height of his reputation. He had argued cases before the Supreme Court. He had written brilliant books. Mudge Rose saying no to Bickel because of his antecedents was like the Chicago Bulls turning down Michael Jordan because they were uncomfortable with black kids from North Carolina. It didn't make any sense. But for stars? The interviewer asked, meaning, wouldn't they have made an exception for you? Bickel. Stars, schmars. In the 1940s and 1950s, the old line law firms of New York operated like a private club. They were all headquartered in downtown Manhattan, in and around Wall Street, in somber, granite-faced buildings. The partners at the top firms graduated from the same Ivy League schools, attended the same churches, and summered in the same oceanside villages on Long Island. They wore conservative gray suits. Their partnerships were known as white shoe firms, in apparent reference to the white buck's favorite at the country club or a cocktail party. And they were very particular in whom they hired. As Irwin Smigel wrote in The Wall Street Lawyer, his study of the old-line New York legal establishment, they were looking for lawyers who are Nordic, have pleasing personalities and clean-cut appearances, are graduates of the right schools, have the right social background and experience in the affairs of the world, and are endowed with tremendous stamina. A former law school dean, in discussing the qualities students needed to obtain a job, offers a somewhat more realistic picture. To get a job, the students should be long enough on family connections, long enough on ability, or long enough on personality, or a combination of these. Something called acceptability is made up of the sum of its parts. If a man has any of these things, he could get a job. If he has two of them, he can have a choice of jobs. If he has three, he could go anywhere. Bickel's hair was not fair. His eyes were not blue. He spoke with an accent, and his family connections consisted principally of being the son of Solomon and Yetta Bickel of Bucharest, Romania, by way, most recently, of Brooklyn. Flom's credentials were no better. He says he felt uncomfortable when he went for his interviews downtown, and of course he did. He was short and ungainly and Jewish, and talked with the flat, nasal tones of his native Brooklyn, and you can imagine how he would have been perceived by some silver-haired patrician in the library. If you were not of the right background and religion and social class, and you came out of law school in that era, you joined some smaller, second-rate upstart law firm on a rung below the big names downtown, or you simply went into business for yourself and took whatever came in the door, that is, whatever legal work the big downtown law firms did not want for themselves. That seems horribly unfair, and it was. But as is so often the case with outliers, buried in that setback was a golden opportunity. The old-line Wall Street law firms had a very specific idea about what it was that they did. They were corporate lawyers. They represented the country's largest and most prestigious companies, and represented meant that they handled the taxes and the legal work behind the issuing of stocks and bonds and made sure their clients did not run afoul of federal regulators. They did not do litigation. That is, they rarely had a division dedicated to defending and filing lawsuits. As Paul Cravath, one of the founders of Cravath, Swain & Moore, one of the very whitest of the white shoe firms, once put it, the lawyer's job was to settle disputes in the conference room, not the courtroom. Among my classmates at Harvard, the thing that bright young guys did was securities law or tax, another white shoe partner remembers. Those were the distinguished fields. Litigation was for hams, not for serious people. Corporations just didn't sue each other in those days. What the old-line firms also did not do was involve themselves in hostile corporate takeovers. It's hard to imagine today, when corporate raiders or private equity firms are constantly swallowing up one company after another, but until the 1970s, it was considered scandalous for one company to buy another company without the target agreeing to be bought. Places like Mudge Rose and the other establishment firms on Wall Street would not touch those kinds of deals. The problem with hostile takeovers is that they were hostile, says Stephen Brill, who founded the trade magazine American Lawyer. It wasn't gentlemanly. If your best buddy from Princeton is the CEO of Company X, and he's been coasting for a long time, and some corporate raider shows up and says this company sucks, it makes you uncomfortable. You think, if he goes, then maybe I go too. It's this whole notion of not upsetting the basic calm and stable order of things. The work that came in the door to the generation of Jewish lawyers coming out of the Bronx and Brooklyn in the 1950s and 1960s then was the work the white shoe firms disdained, litigation and, more importantly, proxy fights, which were the legal maneuver at the center of any hostile takeover bid. An investor would take an interest in a company, He would denounce the management as incompetent and send letters to shareholders trying to get them to give him their proxy so he could vote out the firm's executives. And to run the proxy fight, the only lawyer the investor could get was someone like Joe Flom. In Skadden, the legal historian Lincoln Kaplan describes that early world of takeovers. The winner of a proxy contest was determined in the snake pit. Officially, it was called the counting room. Lawyers for each side met with inspectors of elections, whose job it was to approve or eliminate questionable proxies. The event was often informal, contentious, and unruly. Adversaries were sometimes in t-shirts, eating watermelon or sharing a bottle of scotch. In rare cases, the results of the snake pit could swing the outcome of a contest and turn on a single ballot. Lawyers occasionally tried to fix an election by engineering the appointment of inspectors who were beholden to them. Inspectors commonly smoked cigars provided by each side. Management's lawyer would contest the proxies of the insurgents. "I challenge this," and vice versa. Lawyers who prevailed in the snake pit excelled at winging it. There were lawyers who knew more about the rules of proxy contests, but no one was better in a fight than Joe Flom. Kaplan goes on, "Flom was fat, 100 pounds overweight then," one lawyer said. "Physically unattractive, to a partner he resembled a frog, and indifferent to social niceties. He would fart in public or jab a cigar close to the face of someone he was talking to without apology. But in the judgment of colleagues and of some adversaries, his will to win was unsurpassed, and he was often masterful." The white shoe law firms would call in Flom as well when some corporate raider made a run at one of their establishment clients. They wouldn't touch the case, but they were happy to outsource it to Skadden Arps. Flom's early specialty was proxy fights, and that was not what we did, just like we don't do matrimonial work, said Robert Rifkind, a longtime partner at Cravath, Swain & Moore, and therefore we purported not to know about it. I remember once we had an issue involving a proxy fight, and one of my senior corporate partners said, "Well, let's get Joe in." And he came to a conference room, and we all sat around and described the problem, and he told us what to do, and he left. And I said, "We can do that too, you know." And the partner said, "No, no, no, you can't. We're not going to do that." It was just that we didn't do it. Then came the 1970s. The old aversion to lawsuits fell by the wayside. It became easier to borrow money. Federal regulations were relaxed. Markets became internationalized. Investors became more aggressive, and the result was a boom in the number and size of corporate takeovers. In 1980, if you went to the Business Roundtable and took surveys about whether hostile takeovers should be allowed, 2/3 would have said no, Flom remembers. Now, the vote would be almost unanimously yes. Companies needed to be defended against lawsuits from rivals. Hostile suitors needed to be beaten back. Investors who wanted to devour unwilling targets needed help with their legal strategy. And shareholders needed formal representation. The dollar figures involved were enormous. From the mid-1970s to the end of the 1980s, the amount of money involved in mergers and acquisitions every year on Wall Street increased 2,000%, peaking at almost $250 billion. All of a sudden, the things that the old line law firms didn't want to do, hostile takeovers and litigation, were the things that every law firm wanted to do. And who was the expert in these two suddenly critical areas of law? The once marginal second-tier law firm started by the people who couldn't get jobs at the downtown law firms 10 and 15 years earlier. They, the white shoe firms, thought hostile takeovers were beneath contempt until relatively late in the game. And until they decided that, hey, maybe we ought to be in that business, they left me alone, Flom said. And once you get the reputation for doing that kind of work, the business comes to you first. Think of how similar this is to the stories of Bill Joy and Bill Gates. Both of them toiled away in relatively obscure fields without any great hopes for worldly success. But then, boom, the personal computer revolution happened, and they had their 10,000 hours in. They were ready. Flom had the same experience. For 20 years, he perfected his craft at Skadden Arps. Then the world changed, and he was ready. He didn't triumph over adversity. Instead, what started out as adversity ended up being an opportunity. It's not that those guys were smarter lawyers than anyone else, Rifkind says. It's that they had a skill that they'd been working on for years that was suddenly very valuable. Lesson number 2. Demographic Luck. Maurice Janklow enrolled in Brooklyn Law School in 1919. He was the eldest son of Jewish immigrants from Romania. He had seven brothers and sisters. One ended up running a small department store in Brooklyn. Two others were in the haberdashery business. One had a graphic design studio. Another made feather hats. And another worked in the finance department at Tishman Realty. Maurice, however, was the family intellectual, the only one to go to college. He got his law degree and set up a practice on Court Street in downtown Brooklyn. He was an elegant man who dressed in a Homburg and Brooks Brothers suits. In the summer, he wore a straw boater. He married the very beautiful Lillian Levantin, who was the daughter of a prominent Talmudist. He drove a big car. He moved to Queens. He and a partner then took over a writing paper business that gave every indication of making a fortune. Here was a man who looked, for all the world, like the kind of person who should thrive as a lawyer in New York City. He was intelligent and educated. He came from a family well-schooled in the rules of the system. He was living in the most economically vibrant city in the world. But here is the strange thing. It never happened. Maurice Janklow's career did not take off the way that he'd hoped. In his mind, he never really made it beyond Court Street in Brooklyn. He struggled and floundered. Maurice Janklow had a son named Mort, however, who became a lawyer as well, and his son's story is very different from that of the father. Mort Janklow built a law firm from scratch in the 1960s. Then he put together one of the very earliest cable television franchises and sold it for a fortune to Cox Broadcasting. He started a literary agency in the 1970s, and it is today one of the most prestigious in the world. He has his own plane. Every dream that eluded the father was fulfilled by the son. Why did Mort Janklow succeed where Maurice Janklow did not? There are, of course, 100 potential answers to that question. But let's take a page from the analysis of the robber barons of the 1830s and the software programmers of 1955 and look at the differences between the two Janklows in terms of their generation. Is there a perfect time for a New York Jewish lawyer to be born? It turns out that there is. And this same fact that helps explain Mort Janklow's success is the second key to Joe Flom's success as well. Lewis Terman's genius study, as you will recall from the Chris Langan chapter, was an analysis of how children with really high IQs, who were born between 1903 and 1917, turned out as adults. And a study found that there was a group of real successes and a group of real failures, and the successes were far more likely to come from wealthier families. In that sense, the Terman study underscores the argument Annette Leroux makes that what your parents do for a living and the assumptions that accompany the class your parents belong to matters. There's another way to break down the Terman results, though, and that's by when the termites were born. If you divide the termites into two groups, with those born between 1903 and 1911 on one side, and those born between 1912 and 1917 on the other, it turns out that the termite failures are far more likely to have been born in the earlier group. The explanation has to do with two of the great cataclysmic events of the 20th century, the Great Depression and World War II. If you were born after 1912, say in 1915, you got out of college after the worst of the Depression was over, and you were drafted at a young enough age that going away to war for 3 or 4 years was as much an opportunity as it was a disruption, provided you weren't killed in combat, of course. The termites born before 1911, though, graduated from college at the heart of the Depression, when job opportunities were scarce. And they were already in their late 30s when a Second World War hit, meaning that when they were drafted, they had to disrupt career and families and adult lives that were already well underway. To have been born before 1911 is to have been demographically unlucky. The most devastating event of the 20th century hits you at exactly the wrong time. The same demographic logic applies to Jewish lawyers in New York like Maurice Janklow. The doors were closed to them at the big downtown law firms, so they were overwhelmingly solo practitioners, handling wills and divorces and contracts and minor disputes, and in the Depression, the work of the solo practitioner all but disappeared. Nearly half of the members of the Metropolitan Bar earned less than the minimum subsistence level for American families, Gerald Arelbach writes of the Depression years in New York. 1 year later, 1,500 lawyers were prepared to take the pauper's oath to qualify for work relief. Jewish lawyers, approximately half of the Metropolitan Bar, discovered that their practice had become a dignified road to starvation. Regardless of the number of years they spent in practice, their income was strikingly less than that of their Christian colleagues. Maurice Janklow was born in 1902. When the Depression started, he was newly married and had just bought his big car, moved